Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is former co-host Michael Shackelford, a.k.a. the Wizard of Odd. Shaq, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Back in August, Cartwright was on our show talking about the 21 Magic side bet at casinos in Colorado. He said some nice things about you. Do you have anything to add to that discussion?
Yes, I really appreciate all the nice things he said about me. It was nice to hear from an Advantage player with a positive attitude for once and who was thankful for people who helped him and someone who tipped and someone who tried to get the casino on his side as opposed to just having a antagonistic negative attitude about everybody. So, I thought that was a great show, and I thought he played that really well. And I'd be happy to talk more about that from my point of view later on, if you care to ask me about it.
Well, consider yourself asked.
Okay, so I'm going to repeat some stuff that was said on that show, but as you know, that game had been in Colorado for years. I mean, like several years. A great Advantage play right in plain sight. And I am just still astounded that it lasted so long. And someone even asked about it on my forum years ago, and I thought, you know, this is just some, you know, side bet that'll come and go in Colorado. It's, you know, I'm not going to, and it looked kind of complicated to analyze. So I said, this is not big enough, and it's too complicated to fuss with it. But, you know, earlier this year, I started to get more and more inquiries about it. And, you know, I thought, this is still out there. Maybe, you know, maybe this is worth analyzing. So I said something to the effect on my forum, all right, I'm going to analyze this one. I'm finally going to do it. And then Cartwright wrote to me and he said, Mike, please don't write your analysis. Please keep it quiet just for a little while longer. I'm not saying never write about it, but I'm making a lot of money on this right now, and I'm pretty sure it's not going to last much longer. So just, can you hold off like 2 weeks? And I said, well, you know, I would love to write about it now, but you know, in the interest of not blowing a good thing, which I've been accused of before, I said, okay. And I started to analyze it. And Cartwright was really good about going back and forth with me on the analysis. I said, here's what I get. And we were really, really close. I had probably more of a simplistic analysis than he did, but we were probably within like 0.02%. on the house edge,
and only
disagreed on a few very marginal plays. So, but it was good to have his confirmation, and I always like to get a confirmation from somebody before I post something complicated on my site. So, I held off on writing about that, but when Cartwright said, okay, you know, it's not completely dead yet, but it's on life support, you have my blessing to write about it. So I did, and there were still a few people who were still playing it until the doctor signed off on the death certificate, and of course they got mad at me. But you know, you, as a gambling writer, you can't please everybody.
And just, you know, people have to realize nothing lasts forever. Nothing. I mean, just anytime you find a good opportunity, you have to realize that it's got a limited amount of time. And you know, I mean, there were guys who were mad at Ed Thorpe for writing Beat the Dealer, you know what I mean? And it certainly didn't kill card counting by any stretch, so, yeah, anyway, they'll get over it.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. One of the original co-hosts on this show, Frank Nealon, is the fastest video poker player I've ever seen. Although, for some strange reason, in the last 25 years, he's now 25 years older than he used to be. Go figure. Now, on the Wizard of Vegas site, you started a video poker speed challenge with at least two contestants so far. Tell us about that.
Yes, so I have been thinking about doing this for years. What I wanted to do was to set like a record for the fastest accurate video poker player. And I asked you about this years ago, and I asked Frank about it, and both of you said pretty much the same thing. I wish you had asked me 25 years ago when I was in my prime, but now the younger folks can run circles around me. So I didn't really know any of the new blood, so I just put the idea on the shelf. And after the Vegas shooting, I thought that video poker had gotten a bad rap in the media. So I wanted to do something fun with it. And so I posted on the forum, you know, I'd really like to do this challenge. You know, I will pay a modest fee for anyone to, shall we say, set a starting point for this. And I asked for, you know, something close to 2,000 hands an hour, as, shall we say, a starting point. And someone responded.
Wow, wait, 2,000 hands an hour?
Yes. And I didn't, it wasn't an absolute line in the sand, but I recall Frank saying his speed was above 2,000.
Wow.
But, you know, to get something going, I would have accepted 1,500, just anything to, you know.
Yeah, as a benchmark.
Yes, to put a line in the sand. But someone wrote to me on the forum saying, you know, my name is Ken, and I accept your challenge, and I am sure I can do at least 2,200 hands an hour on a bad day and, you know, more on a good day. And I said, great. And we went back and forth a few times, and we agreed to meet at the Santa Fe station, where he said they knew him and they would set the machines on the fastest speed possible for him. And he wanted to do the to play two machines at once. I said, great.
Okay. So this is making more sense. I was thinking 22 hands an hour on one machine. I didn't think that was possible, and it sounds like it probably isn't.
It is, and I will get to the one machine challenge next.
Okay.
But we started with the two machine challenge, and so one day we met there, and he found two machines close to the poker room, and let me go over the rules that I gave him. I said that it was going to be a 10-minute sitting. I had cameras on both machines, and I said that after it was over, I was going to make sure that he played every single hand accurately, and if there were any errors, I was going to deduct three hands from the total he played for every 1% in expected value that he lost due to any errors. He said, great, bring it on. And so we all got set up and started, and he just played super fast. I mean, I didn't have a stopwatch with me at the time, figuring I would count it all up later. So after it was over, I took the footage home, put it through my, and watched it very carefully, stopping at every single hand. You know, most of them I knew he played correctly, but, and by the way, he played full pay deuces wild. But, you know, some of them I wasn't exactly sure of, and all the ones that I knew were borderline plays I checked. And he played 100% of his hands accurately, not a single error.
And sorry to stop you, Santa Fe had no problems with you videotaping this? They didn't mind?
Well, I'm of the policy or philosophy that it's better to ask for forgiveness than ask permission. And I've learned that when you ask to do something in a casino that they don't normally allow, they tend to just default to saying no. And it would have been a huge ordeal to, you know, fight that through the chain of command. And so we just did it. And
wow, I'm surprised nobody noticed it. And
well, we tried to be as discreet as possible, but, you know, we were just we recorded this on cell phones, which looks rather natural these days. And I find the Santa Fe station to be, you know, a easygoing place. We also talked about doing it at the Red Rock, but I have already been strongly scolded about photography twice at the Red Rock. So even though both incidents were years ago, they seem to have a good memory there. So that's why we did it at the Santa Fe instead of the Red Rock, which he preferred. So yeah, absolutely no heat whatsoever. No, not even any looks or anything like that. So yeah, I get home, check each play, and when I divide the number of hands by the 10 minutes that he played at a speed of 2,544 hands per hour.
Wow.
Yes, wow. I mean,
which is like almost 1,300 hands on each machine.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes. And then after that, on the forum, I posted these videos, and of course there was a lot of naysaying. A lot of people commented that, oh, 10 minutes doesn't prove anything. You know, you can't keep up that speed for 8 hours. And of course I agree with that, but I'm not going to sit there and record the guy for 8 hours and then analyze every single hand. So I thought 10 minutes was a good balance between getting a sampling of his speed, that you would see some difficult hands, but, you know, not having to take too long. And a lot of people ask for a single machine challenge. They say, you know, I don't play two machines. Hardly anyone plays two machines at once. How about a challenge that, you know, regular people can relate to? So he came back and he played on one machine, and I don't remember what his speed was there, but it wasn't the 2544. I think it was around, somewhere around 2000. But that record was quickly broken. I put it out on my forum saying, all right, a lot of people want to see a single machine challenge. Who's up for it? And somebody, not a forum member, but a video poker player here in Vegas who very strongly doesn't want his real name known, but on the forum he goes by Dr. Antonius. So he said, I would like to take the single machine challenge. And so, you know, I went back and forth with him a little bit on the rules and conditions, and he was so concerned about anonymity that he played with gloves on, and he was very specific that, you know, I couldn't get his face or anything like that. And for our sitting, he wanted to play at the M. And to make a long story short, after I checked all his hands, and he did make one small error, so I deducted 3 hands for that, he played at a speed on one machine at 2,262 hands per hour.
Wow.
Yes, wow.
I'm just not even used to seeing machines that play
on.
That fast.
With gloves on.
Yes, with gloves on.
And no, but I mean, most of the machines physically could not move that fast. You know what I mean? Like,
those machines at the M were just lightning fast. I don't think that there was any like waiting on the machine. It was just bam. Once you press the button, the cards were there.
Hmm.
I mean, I on slow motion, yes, you could you could see the cards flipping, but it was just so fast. I don't think that he was ever slowed down waiting on anything.
Hmm.
And what game was he playing?
He was playing 9-6 jacks.
Uh huh. Good.
So yeah, both performances were just absolutely amazing. But I would like to throw it out there. To the world, if anyone thinks that they can beat either of these records, please get in touch with me. And again, you have to play for a solid 10 minutes, and there will be that accuracy check. So, yeah.
Wow.
Well, I can beat 50% of all those scores easily.
Bob, when you were in your prime, what was your speed?
I don't know, probably 1,000, 1,200 max.
All right.
I was fast, mm-hmm. but not. I was not a record breaker. I tended to play more complicated games in 9-6 jacks and full pay deuces. When I saw the full pay deuces challenge on your site, it occurred to me that it's been a long time since I played it. When I play deuces now, it's NSU. And NSU is a considerably more complicated game than full pay deuces.
I agree.
And jacks are better is arguably the simplest game. Now, were I to take this challenge, I think I would try to find a double down stud game. Double down stud, for those of you who don't know, there's just one button to hit, yes or no. You're going to... you don't choose cards. All you do is choosing, do you want to increase your bet before you see the last card, or do you not? And for any given pay schedule, it's a memorizable strategy. So you can get very good at that. And so if I were allowed to play double down stud, I would have a chance at beating these records. Now, off chance that you're going to be so unreasonable as to disqualify that, I have no shot at this.
Yeah, I'm afraid that I limit it to games involving five cards, where you have to keep and discard, you know, a standard five-card draw game.
So Pick'em Poker would also be...
Yeah, that would be out too, but I haven't seen Double Down Stud. I haven't seen that game in years. Does it still exist anywhere?
Do not know, but if it did, it would be on an All-Star Poker machine.
All right.
And or one of that. There's several versions of All-Star or All-Star 2 or Star Poker where you have a wide variety of games. And sometimes, frequently, they are obscure games that don't exist anywhere else that aren't worth an entire box. But if you can have eight of these obscure games all in the same box, it gets enough of an audience that the machine gets some play.
Yeah. Interesting thing about Double Down Stud is that it was also a table game.
Mm-hmm.
Not very many placements, but nevertheless, it was one.
Hmm.
All right. Super Bowl prop bets. Since day one on this show, every year in January, you would come on and announce your recommended Super Bowl prop bets. You ran into a real bad streak on no safety. Other than the no safety bet, how has that gone, and are you planning on doing it again in a couple months?
Yes, indeed. I used to just love Super Bowl prop betting, and I used to be like a kid in a candy store with that, just detecting advantages over 10% right and left. But every year, the pickings got thinner and thinner, and maybe I'm a little bit to blame about that for talking about it so much. But if I can help people be better gamblers, I'm happy with that. Nevertheless, every year after year, I just detected advantages getting smaller and smaller, and my wins got smaller, and my losses got bigger in the bad years, and four out of seven safeties certainly did not help.
But that's also four out of 25, but...
Yes, and it's a good example of how
you just picked the wrong seventh.
Yes, but that's a good example of about how you can phrase statistics, to get a point across. And two people can be completely truthful with that, and yet the way they phrase it, the listener will come up with completely different interpretations. But the safeties definitely didn't help, but other things... often didn't go my way either. Overall, I still have done very well with Super Bowl betting. It's just, if you looked at the progression over time, it's been a negative correlation as time goes by. So last year, when you asked me to do it, I just wasn't feeling confident enough to rally my followers to go out there and bet a lot of money. And I could have come on the show and given a lot of caveats, but I just didn't want to do that. If I wasn't going to be out there pounding the pavement like I used to be and betting six figures, it just wasn't something that I wanted to, give a lot of publicity to. Nevertheless, I still bet last year maybe about 10% of what I used to do at the peak of all this. It's still something I like. But, that's your answer.
And well, that doesn't say anything about this year. So are you still of the same mindset that your edge is not what it used to be? And
yeah, I don't think it's ever going to come back. There are some very bright competitors to me out there doing this. And while many of the competitors are going after the player props, while I always preferred the game props, still, I just know, I could say by name, but I'm sure they wouldn't want me to, people that are out there competing with me on these props, and they will, and half the advantage was getting the virgin lines, camping out of the sports book, knowing when they would release the props and being the first one in line to bet them, because they would often just hang awful lines, and it was no longer worth it to me to camp out in a sports book waiting to be the first one in line. So without doing that, again, it wasn't going to be worth much of my time and money.
But you're still saying betting the no safety is an advantage play with a high variance.
Absolutely. I still say that it's fair laying like 19 to 1 on that. And last year, you only had to lay roughly around 7 to 1. So I still say it's a great bet. And it did win last year. However,
it was
the
close.
No overtime and the no 2-point conversion lost, the no scoreless quarter lost, those were all big bridge jumpers. So despite three big bridge jumper losses, I still had a small profit last year, largely and due to a low number of field goals, because I love betting against field goals and kicking points.
All right. Until recently, I've never heard of Dan Lubin. Tell us about him.
Dan Lubin was the inventor of a PyGow poker variant called Easy PyGow, and he's one of these tireless game inventors. He didn't stop with that. He kept on churning out game idea after game idea. He was also a former craps dealer, mostly at the Fiesta Henderson. And he was a very big character on my forum. He went by the handle PyGow Dan. He was a really helpful guy to game inventors. If anyone new came to the forum with their casino game idea, he was happy to help them through all the steps to getting it to the casino and totally for free. I mean, if you offered to give him something, he wouldn't have said no, but just the most helpful guy for this small circle of starving game inventors, as I like to call them. And he wrote a book published by Huntington Press called The Elements of a Successful Casino Game, I believe was the title. And sadly, I think it was in April, Dan died of a heart attack in his sleep at the age, I believe, of 56. And it didn't come as a total shock to probably people who knew him. He had heart surgeries before and was a pretty heavy smoker. So it just goes to show you to don't smoke and to stay in shape. Watch your health.
Dream Card is a videopoker.com game with, to personal opinion, annoying sound effects.
Now, Dream Card.
You're being annoying, Michael. You've been studying this game recently. What have you discovered?
Yes, I discovered that the dream card probabilities that you see in the help files on the screen are wrong. They are actually a little bit lower than the actual probabilities. And I've actually suspected this for a long time. Whenever a new game comes out, I usually bother my contact at IGT and try to nag him for the same kind of files I'm sure you've seen of all their games, pay tables, and return percentages, assuming optimal strategy.
I would get this from Chris Bruni.
Yes. Yes, that is the same person I have nagged a lot over the years. And so this file for Dream Card Poker listed the Dream Card probabilities to 0.1%. But if you look at the screens in the casinos or at videopoker.com, it only says it to the nearest 1%. So, let's see. And one day I asked someone with videopoker.com, their main mathematician, about this. And I said that if I assumed the probabilities that the machine says, I wasn't matching up with their figures, but if I assumed it was, you know, the figures to the nearest tenth of a percent, I did match their numbers doing my own math. And so I brought up to them at a Super Bowl party that, you know, how come the percentages are listed to the nearest 0.1% on your spreadsheet, but only to the nearest percent on the help files? You know, I think that the public has the right to know the exact figure to the nearest tenth of a percent. And he said, oh, I had no idea that they didn't say to the tenth of a percent on the machines. So he said, we'll have to get back to you. And they did. And they said, you know, Mike, you're absolutely right. and we talked to our lawyers about this, and they said that because we are understating the dream card probabilities, that we haven't done anything unethical, that the game is actually better than what the rules say it is. And I agree with them. I think that it's, if you say the probability is 46%, and it's really 46.9%, I don't see any sin there. Nevertheless, I think everyone would agree they probably should have been to the nearest 0.1% all along.
Well, 46.9 rounded would not be 46%.
They were rounding them down on the machines.
Uh-huh, that would be. Okay. Now, I noticed a long time ago that the Dream Card doesn't add much. On when I looked up, like they had bonus poker Dream Card, I think it was at Orleans. And so bonus poker on the 8.5 version was 99,166 in the regular video poker, and like 99,20 in the Dream Card, meaning that it's adding 0.03 something.
Yes.
And is that typical?
Yes, that's definitely typical of the IGT/ActionGaming/VideoPoker.com games, is that they have...
Well, not all of them.
Sometimes it's actually much more than the base game, but usually
like
with the most...
times pay quite a bit more than that.
Right. What I was going to say is that the return with the feature is always more than the base game. Sometimes it's up to 2% more or so, but usually with the most liberal pay table, it's only just a tiny bit more. Would you agree with that?
It can be a 0.25% or 0.33% more. Certainly, a double super times pays 0.5% more. But the more recent games, it's smaller. It's always worth it, variance EV wise, to play the bonus.
Right. I absolutely agree that assuming optimal strategy, you should always bet enough to invoke the feature. But I have noticed that with the most liberal pay tables like NSU deuces or 9-6 jacks, if there's a version for that in whatever the game is with the bonus, it's only going to be a hair higher with the feature. But of course, maybe there's an exception out there. This is just a general rule.
Super times pay is it's a pretty fat hair.
All right,
like 0.2.
Okay, I don't dispute that.
Okay. Video Poker Wizard.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
So that was something not unlike your Video Poker for Winners. It was an app for the iPhone only and other Apple products to help make people better video poker players. You could put in any pay table you wished and it would calculate the return. You could play video poker and it would correct you on your mistakes. And it had a host of different base games you could play. And
why Apple only?
Because I use an Apple, so an iPhone, and I wanted it to start with just what I could actually use on my own phone. So I didn't do any research about number of iPhone users versus Android users. It was just a pretty simple decision. I want it on my phone. So that's how we started, and it was always my business plan that if it did well, we would do it on the Android as well. However, it's not that it did badly. It's that it only made me about $300 a month, and it wasn't worth it to me to justify the expense to also develop an Android version. And that's what the Video Poker Wizard is. And I thought it was really well done. It was done by JB did the most work on that, who is the brilliant guy behind most of the calculators and games on the Wizard sites.
Now, I was talking to Dean Zamzow,
mm-hmm.
who is the creator of Win Poker.
Mm-hmm.
And Win Poker has a app that is one suitable for iPhone, another one suitable for iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And the iPad is not supported anymore because Apple keeps changing its software and does not make them backward compatible. So he would have to redo his program in some key area to make it work on the iPad version, but it still works fine on the iPhone version, which you can install on your iPad. Are you still supporting your app with the new changes in Apple?
Unfortunately not. And I knew this day was coming. About a year ago, my registration as a developer with Apple lapsed because I didn't know about it. I didn't see their email warning me to pay my dues. So because I didn't pay my dues, they dropped it from the App Store. And then when people started to write to me about this, I wrote to them and I paid my dues and I asked them to reinstate the app. And they said no. And I said, why? And they say, you haven't been keeping your code up to date. And I said to them, it's because it was perfect to begin with. It never once needed a correction. And
is perfection a good excuse?
So
have I mentioned I hate Apple?
You know, after this experience, I'm getting close to being with you there. I'm almost there. Hate's a strong word, though. But yeah, they would not renew it, but they did say I don't remember the terminology, but like refresh your code to make it compatible with this operating system, then we will reconsider the matter. And so I went back to JB and I said, will you please, you know, do the coding to satisfy them? You know, and of course I'll pay you, but JB is kind of an enigma. He does what he wants to do, and he was in the middle of doing some other personal interest project at the time, and he wasn't in the mood to do this, so and you just can't argue with it. If he's not in the mood, he's not in the mood.
I might have once been married to JB. That sounds so familiar sometimes. All right.
But yeah, let me finish.
Okay.
So I let it lapse, and then Apple introduced their new, I think it, operating system 10 or whatever it's called, and then even people who had the old Video Poker Wizard suddenly couldn't use it anymore if they uploaded to the new operating system. And I got a lot of comments on the forum and a lot of emails saying, Mike, why doesn't the Video Poker Wizard work anymore? And, you know, I said the same thing many times. It's because it's my fault. I didn't keep up with the code and it's not compliant with their new operating system. It would be nice if Apple were backwards compatible, like you said, Richard, but they're not. So, I asked my boss, the guy who bought my sites, if he could recommend a developer to modernize the code. And he recommended a company in Europe, and we went back and forth, and I was kind of on the fence of hiring them to update the code because I calculated it would take me 4 years to recoup the expense. And to make a long story short, I asked my boss, would you like to just buy the old code and you modernize the code yourself? And he said yes, so I sold it to him, and he's paying these developers that are modernizing the code and are also planning to bring it to the Android. So the Video Poker Wizard should be back for sale in early 2018. Now, unfortunately, people who bought the old version, I don't know that my boss is going to give him a new version for free. I mean, he's having to pay a lot of money to redo the code, and So it's possible you'll have to buy it over again. I just don't know.
But aren't we talking about $10 or something?
Yes, but you would be...
You know video poker players. Oh,
yes, I do. Yes. But we are talking about $10.
Yes, $10 is a lot of money to some people.
They cannot afford to be in a casino in that case. All right, changing subjects. We had a total eclipse of the sun a few months ago, visible over a wide swath of the United States, although not in Las Vegas. What was your strategy for seeing it, and how did that strategy work?
Yes, thank you for asking. I had seen the 2009 total eclipse in China, which was fantastic. And once you've seen one total eclipse, you can't stop there. You have to see more. It's kind of an addiction. So I had been planning on seeing the 2017 one even before the 2009 one. My father was an eclipse nut, and I know that he saw the one over Washington, I think, in 1979, and he put pictures of it in our house, and I could see just how excited he was over that. And I always, because his enthusiasm for that eclipse was so infectious, I always wanted to see one. I really wanted to see one, I think, in the early 90s that went over Cabo San Lucas, but I was just a struggling poor man at that time and couldn't afford to go. And then there was another one in Europe, I think, in 99, and alas, we just had a baby and was, you know, couldn't really justify the expense of going all the way to Europe to see it. But yeah, that 2017 one, I have been thinking about for decades. So, the date finally gets close, and about 6 months away, I look at the map, look at the totality path, thinking about good weather, traffic conditions, proximity to an airport, things like that, and I thought I would try to see it in near Idaho Falls, Idaho. The path would go right over that, and I could either, and it would be a straight shot up the 15 to get there. So I do a hotel search, and everything is booked solid in that part of Idaho. Just everything within 100 miles of Idaho Falls and Rexburg, gone.
The Cactus Pete's always has room for players. They're in Jackpot.
That would have been pretty far away, but I love Cactus Pete's, by the way. Great casino.
Certainly less than 100 miles.
It was more than 100 miles away.
Maybe
not from... The totality, yeah, good point. I think that if you could fly directly north of Cactus Pete's, maybe it was less than 100 miles. But I don't have a map in front of me. But to get from Jackpot, Nevada, to Rexburg, Idaho, you would have to go north, then cut over east, and then north again. So it's not a direct route. And plus, it started at like 11 in the morning. And I was worried about facing a lot of traffic that morning. So I wanted to be where I needed to be, like by 3 a.m. I didn't want to miss it due to being in a traffic jam. And even though that part of Idaho probably doesn't get a great deal of traffic, I had just been hearing horror stories and wanted to take no chances. So I went on Airbnb, and people, the best you could see were people saying, "You can pitch a tent in my backyard for $300, things like this. So I thought, well...
Well, if you can use the bathroom too, it might not be all bad.
Absolutely. I seriously considered doing that or just sleeping in my car. But in so much talking about this on my website, a friend of mine... shall we say, got really enthusiastic about seeing it, and this person probably wouldn't have been too happy about roughing it. So I looked at Boise, Idaho, which has a lot more hotel rooms than Eastern Idaho does. And to start to make a long story short, I decided I would fly into Boise, spend the night there, and then drive a short distance north to the totality path. And where I chose to see it was the city of Huntington, Oregon. And why there? It's right off of an interstate. And so And plus, I figured that all the people coming north would probably, on that interstate, would probably watch it in Baker, Oregon, which is a little bit north. So I knew I might have to fight a lot of Boise traffic to see it, but they could have also have had, those people could have also have headed north on various other roads from Boise. So I thought the competition wouldn't be too bad. And furthermore, I left it about 3 a.m. That night before the eclipse. And there was absolutely no traffic whatsoever. I mean, I flew all the way to Huntington without any traffic whatsoever. And there was signage all over the roads about no parking on the highway during the eclipse. And I saw tons of police cars out there, but very little traffic other than the police. So we get to Huntington at about 3 a.m. and I was worried about finding a parking spot because I already saw websites in Huntington, Oregon, charging like $100 for a parking space. But I get there and I find a parking spot right in front of the general store. It's a very small town. Get there, had plenty of time to kill. So went back to sleep in the car. And when I woke up, there were a lot more people. The town was starting to buzz. A lot of people had arrived after we did and kept arriving. But nevertheless, it was never that crowded. I think a lot of people got suckered into buying a spot at the high school there, which was kind of up on a hill, paying money for that. But there was plenty of free parking in the town. And the weather was pretty good. There was a little bit of smoke from the forest fires. But I had some photography issues, but the eclipse itself was just magnificent, and I didn't encounter much traffic leaving. So absolute, other than having some problems with my camera and a lens, it was a total success. And there's going to be another one on April 8th, 2024, that's going to cut through Mexico, Texas, and all the way up to Maine. So circle that on your calendars now. Don't make any excuses. You know, if you are slightly outside the totality path, it's not the same thing. You have to be in the totality path, or it's just not worth it. It's worth it. It's worth whatever you have to do to get into that totality path. And it could be expensive if you have to fly or drive to see it, but trust me, it's worth it. It is a unforgettable experience that words just cannot explain.
Wow, who knew? Sounds like you, but once if you go, you're committed to going to every other one until you die, because he says once is never enough.
Right.
Yes, and it's not like I have to go to all of them. For example, there's going to be one in 2019 cutting through South America. I'd like to go, but I may not. But I definitely will plan to see any eclipse that is, shall we say, convenient for me to see. There's another one in 2045 when I will be 80 years old. I'm already having my plans set to live long enough to see that one. And if I can catch some more elsewhere in the world, all the better.
Yeah, and if you live to 130, there's several more that you can see.
Absolutely.
All right. I was looking at the Wizard of Odds video poker strategy calculator recently. And I'm actually going to write about it in December on a game I was analyzing. And each game that has the section I was in for a 52-card deck, you display the number of times each pay schedule category appears in some 19 trillion and change times.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in 9-6 jacks or better, the royal flush comes out almost 494 million times in that interval. Who knew? Now, although it might seem obvious that I should know how this 19 trillion number is calculated, I don't. What does that 19 trillion represent?
That represents the number of possible combinations of the way the cards could come out on the deal, as well as the draw, times 5.
Why times 5?
Okay, I thought you would ask. So, the number of possible ways you can choose 5 cards out of 52 on the deal is 2,598,960, if I'm not mistaken.
You're not.
So, almost 2.6 million. However, there are a number of ways the cards could come out on the draw. Of course, if you keep a pat hand, there's just that one combination. Nothing changes. If you throw away one card, there are 47 ways you can get a replacement cards. If you throw away two cards, there are 1,081 combinations of the way you can choose two cards out of 47. If you throw away three, there are 16,215 ways you can choose three cards out of 47. If you throw away four, there are 178,365 ways you can choose four cards out of 47. And finally, if you throw away everything, there are 1,533,939 ways you can choose five cards out of the remaining 47. Now, the least common denominator of all those numbers is 7,669,695. In other words, all those numbers that I just said go evenly into that 7.7 million number. The largest number, the 1.5 million for throwing away all five cards, goes into it exactly five times. So
the 7.6 million times 2.6 million comes out to be your 19 trillion.
Yes, exactly. So that's why I had to apply a little bit of this weighting factor to get all the combinations equal according to how many cards you throw away after the deal. So again, it's 52 choose 5 times 47 choose 5 times 5. And that comes to 19,933,230,517,200.
Uh-huh. Good.
That's a lot of video poker.
Yeah, it takes more than a weekend for sure. Good. And I'm sure many of our listeners' eyes are glazing over, but I'm actually very glad I asked the question.
Well, let me add something to this. Is sometimes when people talk about this, they will talk about a 19.9 trillion cycle. And when you say the word cycle, I think the association in a lot of players' heads is that, oh, all these outcomes are predetermined in this great big loop, and they think the same thing about slot machines. The same term is used about slot machines. So I try very carefully not to say the word cycle when I'm talking about this. Nevertheless, in the industry, that word gets tossed around all the time. So, but I want to be very clear that in both slot machines and video poker, the games are random and the outcomes are determined by random numbers. And as you guys know, the past makes absolutely no difference unless it's a progressive game, in which case there are different states. And a lot of the new video poker games also and slot machines have variable states also. Nevertheless, what you will win might be different from time to time, but the probabilities are always the same.
All right. With those caveats, we're going to cycle on to some commercials. We'll be right back.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In December, most things in the casino are half price using points between December 17th and 24th, including rooms, meals, New York's Eve shows, other show tickets, bowling, movies, etc. Points do not have to be earned in December, although they may be if you like. This is the normal December promotion for the South Point. Only it's somewhat hyphenated this year because the NFR rodeo started a little bit later than usual. There will be free video poker classes on Tuesday, beginning January 9th. The schedule may be found on bobdancer.com. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is 100 play poker with quick quads. This is a 6-coin per line. What I like to talk about this time is the wheel poker version of quick quads, which is 7 coins per line game. The reason I want to talk about that is because that's going to be one of the classes in the video poker semester coming up. Quick quads has very different strategies than the regular game, and it's a lot of fun. Wheel poker adds some different strategy to the mix as well. It's a 99.8 8% version with the 0.3 slot club. It's positive 24/7, even more so on double point days, and which include the mailers. It comes in quarter triple play and five play, which means $5.25 per hand or $8.75 a hand, depending on whether you're playing triple play or five play. And so if that is within your comfort zone, it's a very good game to learn.
All right, we're back talking to Michael Shackelford, the Wizard of Odds. There was a Game Inventors Conference recently that you mentioned on your website glowingly. Tell us about that.
Yes, this is called the Cutting Edge Table Games Conference. It's once a year, usually in November, and it is meant for people in the table games business. And they have a lot of sessions about everything to do with table games. But it's also an opportunity for game inventors to show their new games. And this is a venue that caters to the little guy. This is an affordable place for the little guy to rent a booth and show people his game. And there will be a lot of casino executives there looking at all the new games. And there is voting for the best game, and they give prizes for the top three, and the winner is guaranteed a field trial by the a casino that sponsors this event. And it's a really small, friendly show. I always have a great time at it. On the Wizard of Odds, if you click on the video section, you will see a lot of videos that I've made from the show where I interview people at the show, asking them to tell me about their game and to demonstrate it for me. And I like the show because it seems like I know half the people in the room. It's kind of a small world of game inventors. And Scientific Games puts out a couple games, but this is a place for the little guy to really shine. Whereas G2E has become too expensive for the little guy to rent a booth. So there you still see the big companies like Scientific Games and Galaxy and AGS with their booths, but you don't see any of the independent people anymore.
At this little show, would there be people from IGT or videopoker.com coming and looking at them? Or is it strictly table games?
Yeah, strictly table games. You will not see a single machine in the room. And I wouldn't say it's a little show. It's a medium show. You will see about 40 games demonstrated there, and sessions, I think, get an audience of up to, 1 to 200 people.
Very good. Pai Gao Tiles. I've heard you're working on a strategy or have completed a strategy. Give us the 7 minutes or less version of this.
Okay. As my close followers know, I love Pai Gao Tiles. I think that if every game had the same house advantage, Pai Gao Tiles would be my game of choice. If I may toot my own horn, I think that I'm the first one to write about the game to a wide audience. It was not easy to find the rules of the game when I first took an interest of it when I was still living in Baltimore. Nevertheless, finally I was able to get the rules of the game in English and started to analyze the game. And Pai Gao Tiles is not an easy game to write a strategy for. The rules are complicated and the strategy is complicated. It's kind of difficult to explain why without knowing the game, but there is a hierarchy of the tiles. And if it's a little bit like Baccarat, where you combine two tiles and add up the dots and drop the first digit. But if that is a tie, then you look at the ranking of the tiles to break the tie. And there are a lot of ties. So it's very important to have a good kicker in any hand, if you can. But that makes the strategy really complicated. I mean, it could be very simply stated, as much like Pai Gao Poker, as lots of times you're put to a decision of, do I make a strong hand and a weak hand, or two mediocre hands? And there's no easy answer to that. I find that the house way is much too conservative towards balancing. and which makes the player strategy, the optimal strategy, more aggressive in terms of trying to make a good low hand. And if you can't make a decent low hand, then to forget the low hand and make the high as good as you can. Nevertheless, there's no good rules of thumb that explain every situation in PyGow. And between me and JB, we have three or four strategies on PyGow on the website, but I always felt that they were too complicated. And I personally had difficulty memorizing them. So I have so many things like in the back of my mind, project ideas. And one of them was to finally one day get serious and to try to make a good PyGow strategy that I could fit on a small card that didn't make too many sacrifices in power. So JB kindly gave me a spreadsheet that there's some, I don't remember, some like 2,600 possible situations in PyGow, and he listed every single one of them, and the expected value of playing all three ways is very, as well as various other statistics. So I just made an enormous spreadsheet, starting with what JB was, trying to separate hands into different categories, and then separating them different ways. Like if I go with this rule of thumb, what's the return of the game? If I change this one, how is it affected? Is it worth it to throw in this rule? And I went back and forth with myself a lot, again, trying to balance power and simplicity. But at the end of the day, I came up with something that I'm pretty proud of. It can be found on the Wizard of Odds under the PyGow basic strategy. And it's something that I'm pretty proud of. You can see here I brought each of you a copy, and it just breaks down the hands into first four categories, whether or not you have a pair. Then, if you have only one way to play a high nine, gong, or wong. Thirdly, if you have two or more ways to play a high nine, gong, or wong. And finally, every other possible hand. And then three of these four are broken down into other categories that work like video poker, saying, if you can do this, then do it. If you can't, then this is the next best option. If you can't, then this. Breaking down the hands into different subcategories. And at the end of the day, it's too much to explain in 7 minutes, but it's something I'm pretty proud of. And if I remember correctly off the top of my head, it is only at a cost of errors of about 0.2%. And that may sound like a lot for a video poker player, but again, video, it's really difficult to get a handle on PyGow tile strategy. And 0.2 is a lot less than the difference between the house way and optimal strategy in PyGow. So it's something that I'm pretty proud of.
Have you analyzed how this would do against the house way?
Yes, what I just said, absolutely. And that's on my website. I don't remember the figures off the top of my head, but but if forced, it's nearly a break-even game if you're banking, and the house advantage is about 2% if you're not banking. So if you can bank every other time, the house advantage is about 1%. And yes, I know there are better bets out there, but if you are playing just for recreational purposes, which I'm sure you two never do, but...
Well, no, some people like to play games with really small edges for the comps.
Yes, right? it's a great game for comps, depending on the casino.
Or the invitations.
Yes, because it's slow, it's very low volatility. You either win even money, lose or push. A lot of pushes, only about 30 hands an hour, and if you can pack a table with your friends, it's really easy to slow down the game and to not play all the time saying, oh, my friend is banking, I don't want to win his money, I'm going to sit out. So hopefully now, the casino won't punish you for slow playing it, but yeah.
Now, I've known a few people over the years who actually thought that they had a winning strategy for PyGow tiles. John Gwynn talked about it originally. Did a lot of the early blackjack work.
Mm-hmm.
John Chang talked about it on the show, But he felt when he actually went out to play it, he just felt like he was being cheated whenever he played because everybody else at the table was talking Chinese and it just felt fishy to him. So have you looked at that? I mean, I'm wondering how they found this edge that I'm surprised you wouldn't have found it if it's there.
Yeah, I'll have to talk with John about that, but I can say that if you...
Maybe it was because the players are playing so badly that if you're banking and using a better strategy, you can get an edge that way.
That could be. I'm of the opinion that these hardcore Asian players are pretty good. I don't always agree with how they play, but they play something pretty close to the house way. And even if you're playing optimal strategy against the house way, there's still that house advantage. You will have a small advantage when you're banking, but a pretty big disadvantage when you're not. So, of course, you can't bank all the time. Maybe in California you could, but here in Las Vegas, you have to take your turn. And
the other problem is in California, there's so much cheating at this game in particular, that it can be really dangerous to try to play in California. I have had several friends who were banking the game in California. One of them said, he would do fine, but every so many hours you have to go to the bathroom. And he would run to the bathroom and come back, and lo and behold, somebody had won $10,000 while he was in the bathroom, So, I had friends who did not have great success trying to bank Pai Gow tiles.
Yeah, and this is... I've heard a lot of anecdotal stories about unbelievable losses banking, not just in Pai Gow, but in any game in the California casinos. I have a friend who shall remain nameless who used to bank in the Bay Area casinos, and everything went fine for a while, but he had, shall we say, a confrontation in the parking lot, but he kept on doing it, and then suddenly he just lost like crazy. I mean, a lot of people will say that, but this is a guy who is a professional gambler, and if he says, I lost like crazy, I believe him. And he said, I just know I was getting cheated. I could prove nothing, so I just quit doing it.
Yeah, I also had friends who have a banking corporation. They've been, corporate bankers in California for almost 20 years now.
Yes.
And they got solicited by a card room to come in and bank the Pai Gow tiles. And the whole thing was a setup by the casino itself. They had one of those electronic tables that all the tiles go into the table and get shuffled and then come back up on a little elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a cheating table. And the casino had solicited them to come bank just so that they could cheat them, I told you this story before we went on the air, but it bears repeating, I think. When I first came to Las Vegas, I was a dealer at the Golden Nugget in 1978, and I believe the Golden Nugget was the first casino to put in Pai Gow tiles. And I was standing on a dead game, and the shift boss was standing there talking to me, and he was watching the tile game, and he shook his head, and he said, that game has been here 6 months, and we have never booked a winner.
And every day for 6 months, the casino lost.
Lost, yes. And I was like, how long are you going to let that go on? I mean, you are the casino. You're supposed to have the edge. And, but people above him were making those decisions. But it was a game that had all Chinese players, all Chinese dealers. They were all talking in Chinese the whole time. And, it never won. So.
Yeah, I am not an expert at it, but I do know that Pai Gow is one of the more vulnerable games to cheating. I know Bill Zender, who is a game protection expert, and he says that the Desert Inn was also one of the first casinos in Vegas to offer Pai Gow, and he was hired to go in there and try to find out why they were losing money at it. And I can't speak for him, but as I recall, he said that they were just making all kinds of mistakes right and left in game security, and he did what he had to do to clean it up. But between marking tiles and collusion and who knows what else, there's all kinds of ways that game can be cheated.
Yeah.
In regular Pai Gow, The house rules, or the house way to set a hand in the California clubs, is different than the house way in most of the Vegas casinos.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, there would be a different optimal strategy for players to use, because players need to base their strategy on what the house is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Does that kind of difference in the house way of setting hands, does that exist in Pigal tiles as well?
I have never seen a Pigal tiles house way for a California casino. I will say that Pigal poker in California, the joker is fully wild, so that might necessitate a different house way. But in tiles, the rules are the same anywhere you go. Nevertheless, I have seen about a dozen house ways from around the United States, and they're pretty much the same, varying only in some obscure exceptions. I think that they're also way too complicated. I think that with one piece of paper, you could have a more powerful house way than a 20-page house way that they currently use.
You know, now also, I believe it's possible to beat the game with collusion if you put six players on the game that are all sharing information. Have you looked at that at all?
Yes. No, I mean, I'm sorry, I haven't.
The edge is still pretty small.
Yes. But. So, yeah, there's 32 tiles, so 32 divided by 4 is 8. So there's would be 7 possible player positions, but the casinos always, correctly for them, block one out. They just put a laminar on the table saying no one plays here. And players can ask to have it moved around. But they're smart enough to know that you can't have a full table of players, because if they colluded, they could figure out exactly what the dealer's tiles were. So now if you have a full table of colluders, you could only narrow it down to 8. And I haven't looked at this, but that certainly would cut down the house advantage a lot, but I'm not sure if it cuts it all the way to a player advantage. And to go backwards a little bit, there was a game at the Cutting Edge show called Face Up Pigal Poker, where you played Pigal Poker against a totally exposed dealer hand. And
I saw that at G2E too.
Yes, yeah. And surprisingly, it doesn't really help the player that much. They just had to add on a rule that if the dealer had an ace-high Pigal hand, then it was an automatic push. But I tend to think this, it goes to show you that, if you knew exactly what the dealer's tiles were, I'm sure that it would swing the odds to the player's favor, but not if you could only narrow it down to 8. Nevertheless, I highly suspect, in fact, I pretty much know that when Asian players sit and play the game, they're talking to each other in Chinese or Vietnamese about the tiles to try to narrow it down what the dealer has. And sometimes if you can tell that all the teen and day tiles are already out, that can tell you a lot about strategy.
And in Pigal poker,
mm-hmm.
one of the ways to win is to bet relatively small when you're the player and have a huge gambler out there when you're the banker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming this would work in Pigal tiles as well. The problem being, I would think having a Caucasian banker must be a problem for some Asian gamblers. I don't know this for a fact, but I would assume there would be an anti-round eye prejudice among at least some of the players. Do you know that this is true? Or?
That absolutely is true. I have experienced this many a times. One time I sat down at a table where 4 Asian players were already playing, and immediately they all 4 got up and left. It's happened other times where I've played and I could just tell from the mannerisms of the other players that they didn't like me there. But when a Caucasian player asks to bank, that is a surefire way to get a lot of them angry. They might say, this table has been running good. Why are you going to mess it up by banking? They can be quite hostile about it. Not all of them. Sometimes they're polite. The nice ones will say, it's your right to bank. I'm just going to sit out if you do. I would prefer you didn't, but it's your right. You see the whole range. So I don't think that banking in Las Vegas is a viable advantage play, especially if you're white. Because I just don't think that the players will like to bank against you. I think that if, it's just not a viable advantage play, in my opinion.
Interesting stuff. Thank you, Michael Shackelford, Wizard of Odds.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.